Bekitzer, a little summary. In other words, you're saying halachically, now we're talking about, your feeling is that handshakes are permissible?
Yes.
Okay. Your feeling is also clearly that touching a person of the opposite sex, even though one may think that it's being done to comfort the person.
It is being done to comfort the person, but it's got certain overtones that make it unacceptable.
It is unacceptable.
That's what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay, the next...
What about in the nursing care? Is that different?
Nursing care is entirely different. For example, a male nurse with a female patient. That's the essential services that are performed are in the nature of a handshake or better. Even better than that. I mean, that's much less of a problem.
All kinds of emotional give and take and transference and counter transference. Isn't that the same kind of thing without the touching?
The psychiatric problems are extremely complex. And I don't know if we can deal with them all tonight, particularly since there aren't any psychiatrists around. The psychiatrist has even more difficulties than the practitioner of physical medicine in many different ways. In the emotional components that go into the psychiatric process, there is no question that there's a certain amount of identification, of transference, and countertransference, what have you, and an observant psychiatrist has to be very careful not to overstep the bounds. I mean, it's very clear that certain forms of emotional involvement are certainly out of bounds. They should not be permitted to arise in the course of therapy. And, you know, psychiatrists ought to look for other forms of therapy. But I think that's taken us a little bit far afield.
The last item that we seem not to have covered, the written questions at this point, revolves around what we'd call the foratzta, which is how insistent should the doctor be that his patient is observing mitzvahs at the same time that he's being treated. For example, first of all, should you should you ask a patient in the hospital whom you know not to be observant to eat a kosher diet, first of all. Secondly, if the patient refuses, should you try to convince him to, in which case you might be converting him from a shogeg to a mezid? Should you, somebody asked the question about obligation to inform patients regarding transgressions. I don't know what transgressions you're talking about.
Yeah, well, we covered that most of last night. The patient who comes in seeking an abortion and telling you she's going to have one,
okay,
she's going to have a tubal ligation.
Okay, but basically, I mean, I could tell more stories about this.
Oh, let's talk about the positive first. What about kosher food and what have you? There's a Rashi in the end of Kiddushin. It's very interesting. And I have a story that I've used on many occasions. I think that the story illuminates Pshat in the Rashi. I'll start with the story first. In Shari Tzedek Hospital, I'm told, once upon a time, when Dr. Wallach was still alive, he was the German doctor, was the founder of Shari Tzedek, he used to have a beautiful little practice. He went to visit every patient, and went to be in Vakachel, visited the sick, it's a mitzvah, doctors aren't exempt. And he, in the course of the conversation, asked the patient for the patient's mother's Hebrew name. And this name then went down to the Shamus and the Beis Medrash, Shari Tzedek has a little shul, and after every tefillah, the Shamus leads everybody in saying tefillin, and there's a Misha Berach for every patient in the hospital. And this, I was told, is a story. I was told this, you know, how it was once upon a time in Shari Tzedek, what a wonderful place it was. I'm sorry?
150 patients,
150 Jewish patients. Okay, well, whatever. But again.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, fine. Nice. Now, the Kasha. Shari Tzedek is a fairly efficient place. Dr. Wallach was a German Jew. They were known as very meticulous, Masuda. You go into Shari Tzedek, you fill out forms, duplicate, triplicate, quadruplicate. Couldn't he add another line to the form, another copy, and send it to the Shamus? We've got to waste his time with all this business for. We've got to go to the patients, test the patients even. The more efficient way of getting the information. I think that there was a reason for all of this. The Rashi in the end of Kiddushin on the Mishnah of Teishu Vareishim Lekehenim, there's some doctors who don't practice medicine the way they're supposed to, and they don't get rewarded. They get the opposite. Says Rashi, what are the terrible things that these doctors do? He proceeds to list all their averus. He says Rashi, Machila Imachol Brim, Ashkei Imachol Brim. The doctor gives the patient a normal diet. He doesn't prescribe a bland diet. He lets the patient drink whatever he wants. Doesn't take him off alcohol. The Einoi Mishaber Liboi Lamoka. Now, once upon a time,
I am.
My problem is how to translate it. When I would learn the Mishnah as a kid, I translated "Einu Mishaber Liba Lamoka" meant that this doctor, Mishaber Liba, he doesn't break his heart. He doesn't humble himself. He's a doctor. He thinks he's a demigod. He thinks he's it. And we're dealing with essentially two different sets of transgressions. One involves the doctor-patient relationship, and the other involves the doctor-God relationship. Fine. Then there are no antecedents in Lashon Kodesh often, so that there's no parallel between them. Machila means the patient, and Eino Meshaber Liba is the doctor. So we've got pronouns with nouns that have to be assumed, and the nouns are not the same. But after the story, I think I understand Rashi a little bit differently. It seems to me that the physician's obligations extend beyond just prescribing medicine. And when Rashi says, Machiloi Machlo Brim, he's talking about what the doctor does to the patient. And when he says, Einu Meshaber Liba Lamokim, he means that the doctor doesn't affect the heart of the patient vis-a-vis God. And Yasher Koach to Dr. Schlesinger for pointing it all out. Because if the clerk of the office asks you the mother's Hebrew name and sends the slip to the shamans, that's cold. That's another item of information. When the doctor goes to the patient and after he takes the pulse and does the blood pressure and asks for the doctor's the mother's Hebrew name, and the patient knows exactly why he's being asked, I think that the doctor has conveyed a very eloquent message and has conveyed it very subtly. He's been mechasek emuna in a certain extent. I told the patient that there's another member of this team besides the doctors and the nurses. God's got a place in this institution, and it's a message that gets across. And when Rashi says "Einu Meshaber Liba Lamokim," he is in effect saying that the doctor is in a unique position. He can do the job more effectively than anybody else, and he has a commensurate obligation to make the patient aware of certain things. And going back to the question, I definitely think that there is an obligation. How to fulfill the obligation becomes another matter. A doctor has an obligation of Bikur Cholim, he has an obligation of Chech to Chech HaSemisech, he's no worse than any other Jew. If another Jew has to visit the patient, the doctor has to visit the patient. If another Jew has to warn, admonish, and cajole, then the doctor has to do the same thing. The question of how do you do it effectively? I think that the most effective way to do it is by example. A patient sees that there's a community with physicians marching around with beards, yarmulkes, and clean tzitzis, as we spoke about yesterday. This is bound to have an effect upon the patient. And to get across a message, a picture is worth 1,000 words. This is worth 10,000 words, much more than 10,000 words, and it's bound to get across. And when the patient gets the idea from the doctor that in addition to consulting medical books, he's got some Shulchan Aruch out there, there's a moral code that he's also consulting and that he feels bound by it, I think that this speaks words to the patient. How to go about it, I don't think that a hard sell is particularly effective. I'm not concerned in Macholos Asuras, I'm not so much concerned with Lutik Shishagin, these are things in Mefurish B'Krah. What's open and clear and clear-cut, you don't have to worry about the patient becoming amazed, doing it willfully instead of doing it out of ignorance. By the same token, hammering away at the patient isn't likely to have terribly much effect. It's all a matter of assessing the patient and assessing how much effect you think you're going to have and what's the best way of going about it. I think that if you're dealing with a patient who knows the difference between kosher and non-kosher, it doesn't harm to inform the patient, you know that kosher food is available in this hospital, and you might like to avail yourself of it, and I think it would be a good idea if you did. And it certainly doesn't harm in a very gentle and subtle way to be mechazik emuna in a patient in one form or another. And, you know, whatever way one goes about doing it, it is all to the benefit. But I think that the most effective way, you know, that doesn't mean that the less effective ways should not be used as well. And these things become cumulative in nature. But I think that the presence of people like this in the community, particularly in such numbers, is in and of itself the greatest form of tekoche, and probably the method that's going to be the most effective, both in the long run and the short run. I mean, this is a rather unique community. I haven't seen very many like it, to be very honest about it.
And a more practical, getting down to more nitty-gritty, a doctor normally writes orders on his patient when admitted.
Yes.
That's it. Why would you think of not writing a kosher diet automatically? The patient is a tasty diet. Except they don't realize that they probably give them meat three times. They did the same thing.
That's right.
That happened already. All these things have happened.
You write kosher food on the orders. Without saying anything to the patient, you know, he gets the tray, he's going to call over at the nurse and say, what's this? Why don't you bring me real food?
Well, the doctor ordered it.
The doctor ordered it.
You know,
I'm ready.
You can put down a veterinarian diet also.
Look, you can't do something that's going to destroy your credibility totally and completely. You can't admit a patient for, for a boil that you're going to lance and say that you've got to have a vegetarian diet. You know, it just doesn't, it won't play in Peoria.
No
one's
going to
buy it.
They're
not going to buy it.
I
want to
just add a little bit, because this is a very sensitive area, and I think what you just said, Rabbi Black, is evident. I mean, the doctors can accomplish more than a fellow on the street, but the whole concept of doing it in the right way, which you emphasized, I think is the whole key to the whole thing. In other words, if you do it the wrong way, it's not shot, you stay in the middle, you lose.
Of course.
And if you do it the right way, you gain respectability and frumkeit and everything. I mean, you could ask the same thing. Every balabas, should he make his workers, he should force his workers to put on phone to keep Shabbos? I mean, he's...
Yeah, there's a fire.
So if you do it the right way, you'll gain steady ground. And you do it the wrong way, when they'll leave you, they'll leave an enemy, and they'll leave frumkeit. And that's the key. I've seen it. The reason I say this, I've seen it time and time
again. Yes, it's true.
Got a balabas here in the city. You hire a worker, you have a lot of workers. You put in a worker's contract that he gets the job. One of the conditions is he come three times a day without him. The guy came to him, he was a frum, he was nothing. Put in his contract, the guy needed the job very badly. So he agreed. He agreed to condition the contract. And he stayed in the job for a day or two, and that's it.
Yeah. What happened, for example, if a lady comes for an abortion, and you are the one, it seems...
Well, let's take the positive. Let's take the positive. First, you're speaking now. Is it appropriate at any point, either in speaking to the patient about their health in general, or with regards to a specific, more serious situation, let's say, than admitting them for lancing boil or something like that, to tie the doing of positive mitzvahs in with their health or with their treatment?
To the extent that you can do so, by all means. And this depends upon the patient. This depends upon your assessment of the situation. If you're dealing with somebody who has a clear netiya, he's got an inclination toward observance of one kind or another, and you can use this as an opportunity to reinforce it and to cause him to expand upon it, by all means do so.
Am I just saying that this can help in your therapy?
When you're saying that this can help in your therapy, if you're going to operate for appendicitis, you can't very well tell them putting on tefillin every day is going to help cure the appendicitis. It's not going to.
And, well, I have a story about that.
What?
Help them go through the surgery and recovery. In general, it wouldn't hurt to.
No, but if it doesn't hurt to, if you're dealing with a patient who's a maimon, Many patients are. He believes there's a Rabbani Shlomo. Why hasn't he put on tefillin for the last 30 years? Because he's been getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning. He'd go to the business. He didn't have time. And you tell. I'm sorry?
He's jogging.
That's today. 30 years ago he did.
30 years.
And you tell him, look, you've had surgery and you're now in the process of recovering and you're going to spend another 2 weeks in the hospital. You're not going to work 6 o'clock in the morning. And look how wonderful the Rabbani Shloim was. And this is a Maimon. He knows it was the Rabbani Shloim who did it. And you tell him, look, why don't you put on tefillin while you're in the hospital? You have nothing else to do. I find time to put on tefillin before I come to make rounds in the morning. You're doing nothing all day in the hospital. Why not put on tefillin? And if you're dealing with a typical middle-aged Yiddish balabos who has no reason not to put on tefillin except that he has to forgotten, he'll do it. And
New York.
I'm sorry? That's New York. Here you may be dealing with something more basic and more fundamental, in which case something else is appropriate. You've got to deal with each patient differently.
Sometimes you can actually see it as a therapeutic. I had a patient who was actually was a physician, and he came in for a problem with his left hand. It turned out, in the history, I kid you not, he had a Baruch Hashem, we took it, as usually a physician gets shuttled through, you know, cutting corners, but in the form, he had a tumor between his eyes. So naturally, I said, what else naturally needs to put on something? I offered him, don't think he would do it with his hand, this is darker. His hand got better, the tumor recurred between his eyes. So, I mean, to me, I see a direct relationship.
Believe it or not, you should be a rabbi.
Or take me to one.
I'm going to be a doctor too, don't say anything.
It's all about the computer.
What you said last night, talking about how to go about this tactfully. Now the other side of the question, if you have a patient who presents you with a decision to do something that's inappropriate, it's a transgression. You said last night, by all means, let them know that you feel it's repugnant, it's wrong.
Well, yes, sure.
Would that, you know, judging from the patients we have today who can't relate to that the most, that's your way of looking at the situation, has nothing to do with them, or has nothing to do with an absolute moral code, or anything like that.
Well, there's a world of difference between trying to change a patient's lifestyle, you know, one that can put on film every day. You're asking a lot from somebody who's never put on film, doesn't have time for it, has got other things to do, and a situation in which you're telling the patient, look, don't have this tubal ligation, don't have the abortion. You're dealing with something that the patient hasn't done every day of the week for the last 20 years, and you're dealing with something that's essentially a one-time affair, plus you're dealing with something that is, you know, even the most far-out patient knows that there are things going on in the world and that there are people who do find this repugnant, and not just outlandish and esoteric, but they do know that there are people who believe this is a form of homicide or what have you. And to reinforce it on a one-to-one basis, the personal contact is simply reinforcing for the patient what the patient has already discovered someplace else. You know, it's quite different to talk to a patient about an abortion than to talk about somebody who barely knows that he's a Jew about putting on tefillin, you know, somebody who doesn't know what tefillin are, has never seen them, wouldn't know what to do with them. You know, there's two different worlds.
It wouldn't alienate them from...
No, certainly not. I mean, I don't believe that telling a patient that you regard abortion as immoral, I certainly don't think that would alienate any patient. The patient may disagree.
You're always qualifying it by saying, I regard it,
Judaism says, whatever. I mean, what else can you say? What other arguments are you supposed to use?
Yeah,
don't try the humanistic arguments, for heaven's sake. That's not what we're trying to say.
No, I understand that, but I'm saying, sure. If it's a non-Jew, you suggested that we also...
Yes, of course.
Look,
the Bible says, and even the Catholics know the Bible said. You know, some Christians who don't read the Bible, you know, they don't abide by what the Bible said, what have you. But when you're dealing with a non-Jew, it's not that much more difficult. You're talking about things that are universal, and things that can be very well presented in ways that a non-Jew can understand.
That would be the same for a surgical sterilization. More people are aware that many people hold abortion as repugnant, but few people are even aware that someone would consider something wrong with the sterilization.
It may be a little harder to explain, but I don't think that it's harder. Particularly since when you're dealing with sterilization, you can put it in very practical terms. You know how many people have had tried to have vasectomies reversed? These days they're even succeeding in doing it in something like 20 or 30% of cases where it's been attempted, it's been successful. But there are many people who have second thoughts afterwards. I mean, there you've got a whole...
But then that's not a moral approach anymore.
No. It's not a moral approach, but I don't think there's anything wrong with throwing a little bit of that in.
You throw a little of each. And some people take to one
some
thing.
Some will take the other.
Take to the other. Some people take to the
other. Shouldn't the main thrust be whatever words will be accepted?
Of course, it doesn't necessarily have to go with
pure truth, you know, that this is the thing and that's it. If you feel that's what will be accepted.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I think the truth should be added.
Yeah, it has to be. I agree with that. However, if you feel that they will accept that much faster, then that should be the main thrust of the argument.
Many times you don't know the patient well enough to know what line.
Can I throw a curve? It's getting a little late, and everybody's. I just want to ask something along a different line. It's a little, with me, it's a little emotional issue, but it deals clearly with Allah also. The question is, I'm talking about a conservative temple now, okay? Evidently, most of us can, from what I understand, there's no question, you can't doubt on that. But if somebody approached me, there's an issue that happened here in the city. It was a conservative temple, they had 9 people standing there waiting for chakras, and one of our Balabhatim passed by. And so the guys, they started saying, and they needed a minion. So it became a question, should we go and ask this guy, this Balabhas? And so in the temple, he's, no, don't ask him, he's from the Lubavitch, he won't come. And then one guy who's a lawyer said, what do you mean? We need a minion, we'll go out. There are no women here this morning. If there would be women, I know he wouldn't come. Anyway, they went to ask him and gave him a chelik for being a conservative temple and didn't come. So this guy calls me up, Rabbi, I can't understand. Now I'm asking first a purely halakha stance. I mean, I know how I feel. I just don't know if halakha feels. I think it's strange because there's just, the question is a conservative temple, there's a morning minion, no women there that day. There might have been women yesterday.
In the morning weekday minion?
Yeah, they had for a good year or two. Because their rabbi advocates that Dafka women should get aliyahs.
Sure, it helps make the minyan. If you can get them up, why not?
Well, is there a halacha, a clear halacha stand on
it? Is there a clear halacha? I think there is. And I don't think that he should have gone to be mashlim the minyan. But I don't think that by not going he has fulfilled his obligations. By the same token, he could have invited the 9 people to come someplace else to daven, even if it's outside in the street. And to make it very clear, they'll be very happy to daven with him. Either come across the street to the Chabad house or wherever. And even outside in the street.
Well, this is what the guy was arguing for. He said he didn't daven in cattle cars.
But not in the conservative temple. They don't daven. There's certain other places they don't daven. We don't have to talk about. but Bedaki Noyam. I mean, I think in the nicest of ways. I would like to come here, but I cannot. What can I do? I want to come, but I can't.
Exactly.
Do me the favor, so I won't feel bad and come daven outside in the.
That's the issue that Dr. Swalnik brought up. It's the same issue. You see, the guy resented it on 2 levels. What do you mean? We're 9 Eden. He said to me, we couldn't read the Torah, we couldn't say Kaddish. Yeah. You know, so I told him, don't give me any of that emotional garbage. Let's talk. But he resented on another level.
Of course.
That the Balabhas, not knowing how to get out of it, took an attack on the conservative movement in a wrong way.
The anger and venom will not accomplish anything with this generation. I mean, we're beyond that. Those tactics won't work. When you're dealing with the Tinek HaNishpa at this stage, that's not the way to deal with them. The way to deal with them is only mitgutens. And it's very difficult and requires a great deal of diplomacy, but it should be done. It can be done.
Along those lines, of the halacha, would you be able to daven in a room that is not used as a sanctuary?
It's a little bit different, but I can always, you can always fall back on convenient shuvas of Rav Moshe.
If you have a classroom,
they're not davening in the shul, but it's not
conservative.
It's in the building.
In the building, but not within the.
It's
in the conservative
conference. No, sorry.
We're not talking about that.
No. Again, basically, I don't see an objection. Rav Moshe has a tshuva, which he said, look, there the question wasn't davening in a side room, but attending a dinner in a hall or something of the sort. So what does he say? An Odom Choshu shouldn't go. What does it mean an Odom Choshu shouldn't go? It's similar to what we spoke about yesterday in terms of public policy, Das Torah, how it will be perceived. If the Odom Choshu, a person of prominence, goes into the hall, even for purposes of attending a dinner, this gives a stamp of approval. If Joe Blow, whom nobody knows, nobody cares about, goes, the fact that he went isn't going to make any difference. If you're talking about an Adair, go daven, not go daven, it's one thing. If you're talking about eating a piece of celery in a hall, then there's no reason why this guy shouldn't do it, because it's not going to make any difference to anybody. But last night we talked about the definition of a Talmud Chochem, and it's what a person perceives as a Talmud Chochem for certain halachas. An Odom Choshev is what's perceived as an Odom Choshev. If one of these Lubavitcher, as they call them, comes in, that means that Lubavitch is sanctioning the conservative temple. I mean, clearly, this is no place for false anivus, no false humility. Everybody's an Odom Choshev, so if you go into one of the side rooms to daven, it's the same thing. I mean, they will perceive it as being the seal of approval.
What he told me was, he said there was this collector came from Israel with a and he says, and he came to collect from us, and he davened with Armenian. And then he questioned and says, maybe he didn't realize that we're a conservative temple.
He was damned, Mishulak Lekav Schuz. Unfortunately, you and I know too many of them who would go and daven. All right, of course, the Riks have it.
But this happens too.
Along the same lines, and I encounter it on a daily basis, okay? I'm just asking you as a halacha authority whether halachic people are dealing with this and whether it should be dealt with, okay? Everybody knows the controversy with Reform Gairs. Reform and conservative, but that's not the issue. Gairs, okay? Right now, and we see it, in a sense, we're on the forefront, meaning so many people come to us for our camp, for our school, with Gairs. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount, okay?
Good.
And so, we see the problem on the forefront. And every time, no matter how sensitive you are to the people and tell them that they're mentioned, we respect them as human beings, but we can't accept the Gairs, they end up your enemy. And the worst thing is that the Orthodox people are the insensitive people that have brought about this unit. Like a lady told me 2 days ago on the phone, she's a Geris, Shleika Halacha, and it was a question about her kids. One went to our camp, and we didn't know about it. Came to register in the school, so we made a little
and you found
more,
out.
And we found out that we didn't accept the child to the school, and how insensitive we are, and how on. This is 8 years later. She happened to call me about something else. So she's telling me how insensitive you rabbis are in this school and this and that. And then at the end she says, if only there were unity. This gear should like a lot. If only there were unity among us Jewish people. What does it come out? Here we have a mamzer in a sense. A gear, a mamzer meaning a monster.
Okay.
In Klal Yisrael. And the problem is, it exists. But the Orthodox are taking the brunt of it. I see it on the field. We're getting the brunt of it, that we're almost like an Eretz Yisrael. Who are the bad guys? Frumer Rabbanim.
Yeah, sure, of course.
So in Eretz Yisrael, the Frumer Rabbanim aren't into public relations. Right? That's the fact. In America, it's not like that.
Right.
Orthodox Rabbanim are into public relations. Right. And nevertheless, there are hundreds of thousands, and we always seem the bad guys. It would seem to me, I don't know how, it's the same, by the way, in regards, a lady just told me 2 days ago, she says, I got to get a reform rabbi to do our wedding because I know I don't have a get. And so she said to me, I'm getting the reform rabbi because he'll do it without my get.
Right.
So is there a way that we can make our stand known in a more positive way and make it at least seem that the Orthodox from Eden have a stand? And you can choose the Orthodox or the Reform, but they're as much mentioned as them, and this would have to be done in a concerted effort.
I don't have a panacea. I mean, in general, you're right on two fronts. I think there were two parts to the comment or question. One, you know, what to do about publicizing, and B, how to react on the grassroots level. On the grassroots level, I think that the only way to react is to smother the people with kindness. Is that right?
Of that, there's no.
Yeah, problem. Of course. I mean, by all means. Making a point of doing all kinds of other things that make it very clear that we're not we don't have hearts of stone. We have nothing against you, and the rest is we would much like to accommodate you. I mean, the one thing that I've never been able to understand with Balabatim in general. I mean, I Baruch Hashem today I don't have these problems in my shul. Once upon a time, when I was a lot younger, the shul was different. And I did have problems, and I see it constantly with other young rabbonim. I've never been able to understand why a balabos gets angry at a rov who has to say no. I can't perform the gerus, or I can't do X, Y, or Z. What does the rabbi gain by saying no? I've never understood this. The rabbi has nothing to gain from saying no, everything to gain by saying yes. So obviously, if he's saying no, there's what a lawyer calls force majeure, a compelling force. He's got no choice in the matter. Anybody with an ounce of seichel in his head sees that this guy has nothing to gain by being what they call an SOP. Now, so why is he doing it? He must be doing it because he feels in conscience he can't do anything otherwise. So what kind of complaints can you have to this poor fellow? But the Balabatim, for some strange reason, don't understand that. No, it's the bad guy, for whatever reason. I don't know how to explain that to them. Other than by patiently trying to tell the guy, look, if I could, I would do everything possible to accommodate you. Unfortunately, these are the facts in the situation. My heart bleeds for you, literally. It bleeds for him a lot more than his own heart is bleeding. And to tell me, it's unfortunate. What can we do? This is the situation. We've got to live with it. It's not going to help in the majority of cases. It will help in some cases, at least to the extent that...
It won't be an enemy.
Right, precisely. It will help in a minority of cases when you're dealing with intellectually honest people. They'll become not only your enemies, they'll become your best friends. They'll realize you stand for something. And the same guy who screams at you today will go home and think it over, and it'll make an impression on him. It'll make the impression on him, if in no other way, when he goes to the next town and finds somebody who calls himself Orthodox and is ready to do absolutely anything. It doesn't take him terribly long to figure out what's going on here, and he draws his own conclusions. And those conclusions can be very positive in terms of what you're trying to accomplish in the long run. In the short run, it's precisely, that was the second part of your comment, it's the fact that you don't have the kind of unity that's necessary, A, on the grassroots level, and B, in terms of public stands, that makes the problem in the first place. If Rabbi X does it, why can't you? If the collector from Israel davens here, then why can't you? His beard is longer than yours.
That comes up in medical...
That's my question. I realize Orthodoxy isn't united, in other words, all the rabbinical organizations, but shouldn't we, now that we're starting to respond to the public, there's a new Orthodox image.
Of course there is.
Since I've grown up, in the last 20 years, it's unbelievable. When I was becoming from this 20 years ago, my relatives thought I was crazy, and they were from Europe. And now the whole image has changed. Orthodoxy, I mentioned. Now is the time. I don't know the right avenue. I just feel it every time one of these happens. I go through it. I'm a first grade teacher. I don't even.
What's necessary is what the Israelis call hasbara, which in English, when you say propaganda, has a certain connotation that doesn't have in Lashon Kodesh. It's public relations, establishing an image and a position, disseminating it in a way that can be understood. You will not reach everybody, but you will certainly reach more people than you're reaching now. And Mindarfton, what can I say?
It has to be more
to you, Rabbi Blatt.
Where are you from?
No, if you get back to New York and you meet the ones that put the public statements, and then the
I don't make public statements.
When the people that do make the once a year that Gurdjieff or Bonham or whoever says you shouldn't have any pray for shul, together with these, there has to be Hasbara statements.
Well, I'll tell you, I've written twice on this problem. One is a rather lengthy article on conversion, in general, dealing with the problem of conversion for intermarriage, for marriage, the validity of some conversions performed for that purpose, etc. And the other was a signed editorial that I wrote, appeared in Jewish Life, at the time that there were people who were making public statements about a united Beis Din with the Conservative Reform for purposes of Geirus, etc. It was a rather, it was a statement that seemed to have offended some people because I knew I was effective when I became attacked. That's a sure sign that you've accomplished something. There were people in the Reform camp who are nice people, fine people, who are saying, look, why shouldn't we make the first step? We've got these Orthodox who aren't accepting our conversion. We'll insist upon circumcision, mikveh, the whole business, and we'll meet them halfway. We'll accept their standards if they'll accept our geiris. And here appears an editorial saying that they can have milah, they can have tefillah, and if the Beis Din are non-Orthodox clergymen, it's all invalid anyway because you need a Beis Din. This isn't a Beis Din. So now they throw up their hands and they say, well, we can't satisfy these people. Whatever we do isn't good enough. They refuse to accept us as rabbis. That's true. I can't deny it. They've got problems. And, what can we do about it? The truth of the matter is that I felt necessary to write that, not because I was worried that those people will go out and make meal and steal it tomorrow. I couldn't care less whether they do or they don't. It makes very little difference to me whether they do or they don't. But you have the, quotation marks, Orthodox spokesmen who are advocating some type of umbrella organization, which I find unacceptable and felt I had to say something about. And there has been, in some circles, what I would call pussyfooting, refusing to state things clearly and unequivocally. I don't think anything is gained by pushing these things under the carpet. I think it should be stated clearly and unequivocally. And let the chips fall wherever they do. I think that when you're dealing with intelligent people, they will understand and realize. When you're dealing with people who aren't intelligent, you can talk yourself blue in the face and say, Gornish tells me. And in the long run, I think there's more to be gained by a straightforward, unequivocal stand than by trying to blur the areas of disagreement and the problems of controversy.
There's one problem. This is being aggravated now because of the push. Other reform. What Rabbi Engel is speaking about is in the community here, in the school, getting a lot of people who want Jewish education to come from the different countries in the area. And now with the money that's earmarked to go out and try and get converts actively, it's going to seriously affect this problem.
I'm sure you have the problem already. I'm sure.
Yeah, but it's not becoming worse because what they're doing now is that there's a major drive to get those partners that are in marriage that are not Jewish
to convert.
To convert. Yeah.
That's one.
I think that's essentially cosmetic. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I don't see that as really aggravating the problem because whether or not they formally convert, I don't think will increase your problems because whether you push for the conversion or don't push for the conversion, the children very often identify themselves as Reformed Jews without the conversion of the non-Jewish spouse. Remember that when the children are being raised as non-Jews, you're not going to convert the parent who isn't Jewish. You're going to convert them only when there's a kind of a tacit agreement that the children are going to become Jewish anyway, so why not? We'll go through the hocus pocus and you'll become Jewish. Again, to me it seems the Vorm Shel Mavikach, except in terms of the psychological effect.
It'll increase our contact with them, that's all. In other words, the numbers will be more.
Well, the numbers are going to be more because of the more intermarriages.
Not here.
See, there's a different
thing. there can't be more
than there are right now here. Here, if someone marries, if the rabbis have complained here that there are no marriages in any of the temples in the area, if someone marries a Jew, it's only by chance. That is a statement. But that is true here.
We have.
That is true.
You mean they're all anti-Semites? They refuse to go
out. I'm taking everybody's time. A parent came into my office yesterday, and it was a single parent. She was telling how they came over from New York. The parents were traditional. They wanted their son, or their children, to be associated with some Jewish organization, so they sent them to the temple, naturally. So what happened was, it was all well and good until her brother met in the temple a Catholic girl.
In the temple.
In the temple, in the club, and got married to her.
Mm-hmm. An avowed one, or one who turned out to be one of the best of the mother?
No.
What's she doing in the temple?
The dances there are better than the church.
Oh, you mean in the social function?
No, what's worse than the conversions are the gifts that they do. But they don't reverse them.
The remarriage without benefit of the gifts.
Right. So I have this cousin who married this woman. Well, he got divorced. Conservative, and she got divorced to conservative, and now they got married to a conservative. So I made the mistake, well, I don't know if it was a mistake, the first time I met them, talking about the get, because she was married from the first time. So once they got very loud, but once I found out that they're not going to have any children, I let up on my nidurai. Because, I mean, there's no moms are in the scene right away.
Okay.
Well. But, you know, they had a base
in
of nine rabbis, people more religious.
Nine
rabbis.
Couldn't get them in, you know. You're ready for this guy. No, but there is a problem with, in general, in Orthodoxy is not as united as we would hope. And we see this in the matter. When I recently was at a meeting in Washington, American Academy of Neurology, and the course on intensive care in neurology, for some reason, though some of the papers were on this subject of brain death and so forth. And so I felt impelled by what they were saying to go up and you know, they were trying to decide how should doctors decide when to turn off the machine. So, you know, I went up and I told them that this is a question for a rabbi and really they should consult a rabbi. So the guy who was in charge of the session says, you mean like Rabbi J. David Bleich? And, you know, but later when he caught me in the hall, he told me, because then I started to argue with them about these California criteria and Dr. Corona from Northern California was arguing. But later in the hall, he caught me. He says, you know, quotes Rabbi and quotes Frankel, says that if the patient is not sentient, he's not alive. I said, who's he? You know, he's on this side. You know, he's not in the same ethics medical. It's a different Kennedy Center for this or that.
Frankel.
That's what he said. And he said,
Frank! Isaac Frank. He's not a rabbi. He's not even a reformed rabbi.
I don't know. And he quoted him, and I said, who's. So he said, he's, you know.
He's in the Kennedy. He's not. He's in the Kennedy Center.
Kennedy, whatever it is. He's just.
He's the resident Jew.
Anyway, that. All right. So
he's.
So what can I say to him? Here's a guy. Am I going to say, look, the rabbis don't. He's not a rabbi.
Frank's not a rabbi.
What am I going to say to him? You know, but I kept thinking in my mind, and even after we're all. We're finished with the session here. I look at it as a beginning because there are still questions in my mind. No matter how adamant you are, I know that I spoke to Rabbi Levitansky this morning, and his father-in-law holds a different sheet on, let's say, a mic. I know that Rabbi Tendler gave a lecture a few weeks ago, and he holds a different sheet on the countries. I just have a feeling that the Orthodox are not that very, very knowledgeable people in Orthodoxy. I wish they could all get together on one stage in a forum and give us a bottom line, you know, and Rabbi Dworkin, and I wish they could all sit down and come out with this single statement.
Life is not black and white. That's Basila and Mishama. I'm talking...
Yeah, but the point is, you don't understand my point. The point is, if the Orthodox are arguing among themselves, how are they going to turn around to the Reform and say, we were all allowed to argue, but you can't hold a different opinion?
The Reform argument is
wrong. I think that... Robert Black answer the question. I think it's a good. I think it's a good question. I think it's a very valid question. And to you, it's very disturbing. It's confusing and at times disturbing. And rather than everybody else answer.
But what's the answer?
I wish I knew the answer to that question.
What should he do? What would your answer be to Dr. Sharon Teruzan? What should he do under these circumstances?
But what's the specific problem? I have to know what
when you approach a guy, and or in other words, how do you justify differences of opinion among reputable authorities?
You can have differences of opinion with regard to halacha. They've always had.
And how do you, at the same time, tell them that we're allowed to have, but the form are not valid, and this one is not valid?
None of the things that you have raised thus far, at least to me, seem to be areas in which there is legitimate difference of opinion. There are many other things with regard to which there is difference of opinion that's very legitimate. But I don't think that we've touched any of those areas. I'm a little bit confused. When you're dealing with brain death, you know, Isaac Frank's opinion on brain death is not an opinion in halacha. It's not even an opinion in Reform theology. He's a man with some philosophical background who happens to be Jewish, and that's the extent of it.
I didn't know this.
He's got no credentials at all in terms of halacha. I'm sorry.
If I can address him a moment.
Sure.
It's his question, but okay. I'd like to ask maybe a different question for him.
Uh-huh.
Okay. When you go around shopping with different rabbonim for different with the same question.
Yeah.
Okay. And you come with some total of five different answers to the same question.
Right.
Okay.
What do you do?
What should you do? I know that the movement is confusing. Okay.
Right.
Because you come after you answer the question. I don't want to get personal here, but say there is a person, Mr. X, okay? After you answer, Mr. X is going to ask the next one. When the next one he answers, he wants to be sure he's doing the right thing, he's going to ask the next one. Okay?
Right.
So he's going to end up with a whole bag full of Jews.
That's why Alphabeta says you should only go to one mark.
Right.
No, but the implication...
What is the answer?
There's one Abish, he's got one Torah, and he wants to do one thing, right? How can he find
different
things?
That's not necessarily... it's late. I'll start. Rabbonim in Europe had things a lot easier.
I don't want to get personal here, but say there is a person, Mr. X, okay? After you answer, Mr. X is going to ask the next one. When the next one he answers, he wants to be sure he's doing the right thing, he's going to ask the next one. Okay?
Right.
So he's going to end up with a whole bag full of Jews.
That's why Alphabeta says you should only go with one mark.
Right. But the implication... There's one Abish, he's got one Torah, and he wants to do one thing, right?
It's late. I'll start. Rabbonim in Europe had things a lot easier than American rabbonim. I'm a Canadian. A rov in the European city, a woman came to him with a pot and a pan. He told it was kosher, he told it was treif. And that was the end of the story. Today, with a pot and a pan, she's not going to go shopping. But if it's anything more serious than the pot and the pan, you know that you're not the only person being consulted, because even this person is just asking you, but her friend is asking somebody else, and they're going to compare notes sooner or later. Therefore, every time you pass Kanashai, at least I find myself, every time, and today, something else has happened. Once upon a time, the woman who came with the pot and the pan didn't know what's kosher, what's treif. You know, they went to the rov, went to the rov, so that's it. Today, something happened. There's a polarization. You don't have balabatim who are amaratzim anymore. I mean, from balabatim or amaratzim. Everybody is as if they are safe at the minimum. Usually, they're talmidei chachomim of one madrega or another. So that anybody who comes with a shayla or has a whole list of questions, whatever you answer, if you say mutter, there are a list of questions. Why? If you say osir, there's another list of questions. Either voiced or unvoiced. They don't ask you, they're going to ask somebody else. So what do you find? Instead of once upon a time, I've been told, I don't know if it's true these days anymore, but many years ago, I was told that in the German Kehila in New York, you're not allowed to ask why. You go with a Shaila, the Rav Paskins, you can go out. If you're a Yeshiva Bocher and you want to know why, you have to come back the next day to ask why. But when you've asked the Shaila, you can't ask for reasons. It's like, the Shaila, finished. 1, 2, 3, that's it. No questions. No explanations. I find myself, when people call on the telephone with a Shaila, I find myself practicing rabbinic preventive malpractice. I find myself delivering a mini shear because I know that if this person doesn't call somebody else is going to, they're going to find out that there are differences of opinion. So that you've got to give them all the different opinions and then maybe give them the bottom line at the very end. Okay, so that's part of what happens. The Rav in Europe had it easier, not simply because people were more ignorant, but because there was a concept, and it's a concept of halacha, of a Beis Din, and the Rav was the of Beis Din, who had authority in the city. Differences of opinion are not novel. There always were differences of opinion, and it's clear that, you know, to contradict what our neurologist said before, the Rabbeinu Shleilom even wants people in different places to act differently, even though it's one Torah. The Gemara says the Basta Belezer, the cut Eitzim on Shabbos to boil water to bathe the baby, was Machlegas Tanoim, whether you can be Machal Shabbos not for the meal itself, but for the preparations of meal. In Rebbe Lezer's city, they did it week in and week out. And in the next city, somebody tried to do it, and they gave him skila. And that was the halacha. In this place, it's permissible. In the other place, it's not permissible. That's the law of Shaftin v'Shaytrin, Titin l'cha b'chol sherecha. Every city has its Beis Din. The Beis Din paskens the halacha for that city until such time as there's a psak din of the Beis Din HaGodol that becomes binding on all of Klal Yisrael. Wherever there's a legitimate difference of opinion, the difference of opinion exists in two levels. One's a purely theoretical level in which Elu v'Elu differ l'kim chayim. They're both correct, and it's not the case that one is correct, the other is incorrect. And then there's the other question of what are you supposed to do? And when there's a Beis Din in the town, there's a Rav in the town, you go ask him to Shaila, and whatever he says, that's the halach, and that's what you're supposed to do. You don't have to ask beyond. But that's assuming, A, that there's a Rav, B, that the Rav is competent, and C, I suppose, that there's a single Beis Din that has ultimate authority, and there aren't Shtei Bot Edin in Birachas, because if there's Shtei Bot Edin in Birachas, you don't know what to do anymore. In Long Beach, you have six Rabbanim. Wow. Six Rabbanim and a half a shul.
One of the things I mentioned is that the Rebbe has something else, which says in Rav City, Rav's Sakis, even though we normally own a Shmuel, and he said because Lubavitch in many places they are the only shul, or the Rav of the city is Lubavitch, or that it would be valid to go by a Lubavitch opinion even if it were the minority opinion in general.
That's correct. I mean, that's elementary.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no. I don't see. I know in many places there is a problem. People in New York have terrible problems. There are too many rabbonim in New York. And then they're the only thing the person can do, if he wants to be consistent, is to identify himself with some kehila structure, whether the kehila is a chassidish kehila, or it's one of the few kehilas that exist, or it's a kind of yeshivish kehila, which has its Rosh Hashiva or its Rav or what have you, and you have a problem, you go and you ask, and you do what you're told. When you're out of town, then it's either very good or very bad. If you're out of town and it's one cohesive community, then it's got a Rav, there's no problem, ask the Rav what to do. If he doesn't know, he'll ask. Whom he asks is his problem. If you're dealing with the kehila type structure that's it's a panoramic, you're dealing with Lubavitch. Lubavitch has its Meir HaRua. You can ask Lubavitch or Meir HaRua. I presume that people seem to know who they are, and I gather that there seems to be a kind of clear hadroche, at least in Lubavitch, for Lubavitch, and there's no problem. I don't see this as being a real problem, at least in these circles. It becomes a problem in as I see it at least, it becomes a serious problem in the so-called modern Orthodox circles when you're dealing with sincere people. And they don't have anybody to identify with. Where are they supposed to go? And you can't call them on telephone, ask Meshaila. You just can't. So, you know, who do you ask? And what are they supposed to do? And well, they ask two people to get two different opinions. And they can't identify with Rav A more than Rav B. You know, they become totally confused. And I said that I see their problems being much greater than the problem of people who have roots and identity and know where to go.
Yeah, by the way, this is
the second half of the question, which is more basic yet. How explain the difference between these relatively minor disagreements and the major disagreement with reform that you mentioned before? In other words,
the disagreement with reform, I think we all understand. There you're dealing with...
Now, how explain
that to a guy or to a reform. If we are disagreeing, how come they can't disagree with us and be just as valid?
Well, I have made all the way to the opinion of a tenth opinion.
Look, there's a world of difference. You can have... Look, doctors, we use medical analogies. You can have two oncologists who disagree with regard to the appropriate therapy for a given patient. And they're each entitled to their opinion. They're both highly proficient doctors, and they can disagree honestly. The guy who practices holistic medicine or the chiropractor also has an opinion. Now, do you take that guy's opinion seriously? That guy has rejected physical medicine. If he's rejected physical medicine, he cannot give you an opinion with regard to the appropriate mode of chemotherapy. He hasn't accepted the rules of the game. If you haven't accepted the premises, then stop arguing about the conclusions. If you're dealing with two Peskim who have accepted Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, and now that they've worked through a problem and they've gotten two different conclusions, they've come along 99% of the way, and the last step they've diverged a little bit, but these are two conclusions that have emerged from essentially the same approach, the same materials, the same sources, and the same line of authority. How can you compare this to the Reformed clergyman who hasn't accepted any of this and is disagreeing?
And who says he doesn't accept?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you're not disagreeing with regard to a halacha. You're disagreeing with regard to halacha with a capital H. You've rejected the whole business. What are you trying to do here? It becomes a total farce at that point. At that point, it's not something you can take seriously anymore. You take the opinion of a chiropractor seriously.
So they could really advance this as the show cause thing in Eretz Yisrael. Show cause why not to accept them.
Yes, Eretz Yisrael is a different, it's a different series of problems because it becomes political. I think that the problem is very simple in Eretz Yisrael, frankly. I think it's easily resolved. But again, people may not want to resolve it that way. You have to remember that people on both sides are out to make points. The Reform basically want recognition. They'll concede anything for recognition. They'll put on a Rabbeinu Tam's film as long as you give them recognition.
That's all they want.
Yes, that's all
they want.
And by the same token, there's a certain element that wants to deny them everything, perhaps rightly so. The solution is a very simple one. They're right. Give them whatever they want. The same way you give every religious denomination whatever it wants. They're not Jews. Let them call themselves whatever they want to call themselves. Let them set up their own ecclesiastic system the same way that all the denominations have. If they want to accept the status of the Karoim and the Shemraim, I'm purposely not saying of the Copts or the Catholics or the Armenians or what have you, but if they want to identify themselves as sectarians, by all means, let them go ahead and do it. Let them be Messiah of Kedushim, do whatever they want. I don't see how in that society you could prevent them from doing it under those conditions. But that's not acceptable to them. That's not what they want. They want to be recognized as Jews, not as Karaite Jews, not as Shemrini Jews, or what have you. And that's something it's an impossibility. It's a contradiction in terms. It's an unrealistic anticipation on their part, and one which cannot be conceded. But that's...
Can I tell a story before...
Bedtime story.
About the Baal Shem Tov.
Do you want to ask something after?
I don't know if we finished all the medical losses, but I had one to follow, since we were going to be speaking about euthanasia and death and all that, pertaining to animals, which even comes up in my medical practice sometimes, and people associate the doctor with knowing, I guess, care of all living creatures. But anyhow, what are the halachas with regard to putting animals to sleep if they're sick or old, or that type of thing. You mentioned last night castration of animals is also
right.
Forbidden.
Castration is also, but I don't see anything wrong with animal euthanasia.
That's all right for Jews and right?
Yes.
For any
legitimate reason. Otherwise, it can become kind of baltashkes. You certainly don't take a good workhorse and put him to sleep for without a good reason. You know, if the animal's in pain, there's no point in keeping him alive anymore. There's no mitzvah pikuach nefesh for an animal. You can eliminate the animal as painlessly as possible.
Mm-hmm. And the other question I had is on, I touched on it slightly, in regards to kashrut medicines.
Mm-hmm.
And what our obligation is to the patient, either all year round with respect to the kashrut of the medicines, and especially around Pesach,
mm-hmm.
in regards to the chametz.
Pesach, I think you do have a kind of an obligation, a limited obligation, but an obligation nonetheless. An obligation not to prescribe a medication that contains a chometz as an ingredient, particularly when the chometz is not therapeutic, as is usually the case. The chometz is just as a binder or a flavor or what have you. In many cases, for example, in a syrup, I think that is the derech achila of the alcohol. And if the alcohol in the cough syrup is non-therapeutic, then there's absolutely no reason why the patient should be given that on Pesach. And you prescribe a substitute. The therapeutic agents don't present a problem. You just sometimes have to compound the medicine for them.
How far in advance of Pesach do you have to start being concerned about what medicines the patient is going to be taking?
Well, it depends how long you're prescribing the medicine for.
I mean, certain medicines people are taking all year round. Hypertensive medicine.
Well, those medicines don't present problems, usually. But if you know that there's going to be a patient who's going to be on the same pill for the next 12 months, then it might be a good idea to find out now whether the same active ingredients cannot be prescribed in a form that doesn't have chometz and put them on that kind of regimen for the entire period. I think it would be wise to do that in general. The last time I alluded to it very briefly, most medicines, even if it does have an ingredient which is non-kosher, and even assuming that the patient isn't seriously sick and what have you, you're dealing with a form of imbibing which is a shaloi kederach achila, and hence would be permissible even for chelish ein besakona. Now, on Pesach, that's somewhat different. In year-round medicines, the only shayla I see, with the exception of cod liver oil that you give somebody who's not sick, once upon a time people did this. they took cod liver oil as a kind of dietary supplement, even if the patient wasn't...
Vitamin C.
What's vitamin C made out of? And how's it made? Cod liver oil is a simple liver extract.
I was raised on that.
You were raised on, yeah, but people don't do that anymore. It's cod liver oil. I'm convinced it's a shloike derech achila. It tastes terrible, and it's mutter for chelish ein beisakana, but not as a simple dietary supplement. But the major problem, as I see it, is the gelatin capsule, which for many poskim is shloike derech achila in any event, and otherwise, as I said last night, the tissue. The Pesach shaylos are somewhat more significant because shloike derech achila would also be also, particularly if the chometz content is not therapeutic. And there, it's simply a matter of finding out the ingredients, because you can provide exactly the same thing without chometz.
So theoretically, you should be doing that all year round.
Well, it might be simpler to do it all year round when you're dealing with patients with high blood pressure, and you're prescribing something for hypertension, you know they're going to be on it for forever, what have you. Otherwise, you don't keep patients on medication for extended periods of time, I hope.
Only for the chronic.
Yeah, only what else? Somebody's got Parkinson's disease, you're giving them
heart
dopa.
Heart failure, lung disease, chronic heart failure.
Chronic heart conditions, you give them nitroglycerin or what have you, that they're going to keep on taking. I understand. Digitalis or something. If you know that you're going to keep the patient on this for a long period of time, I would try to prescribe a non-chometz medicine for the whole year. Otherwise, I think I would tell the patient before Pesach you assume that he doesn't eat chametz on Pesach and say that this is a substitute. But I think it's a good idea as long as it's medically as good as the chametz preparation to give him the non chametz one in general. And when the other preparation that contains chametz is medically more effective for that patient, that condition, I'm not sure I would change it for Pesach either. I'd probably look for other ways. There are other ways. By having the druggist compounded, let him play apothecary once in a while. Mm-hmm. Instead of just taking pills from a big jar and putting it in a little jar.
But usually the capsules, he puts it into a gelatin.
Oh, you know about the book, I presume. You know...
J.J. Hepp?
Not J.J. Hepp. It's David Horowitz. Well, David Horowitz and somebody by the name of Loiki put out a pamphlet before Pesach this year, listing everything in the PDR. At least everybody who answered, every one of the drug, most of them did, indicating exactly what's in the compound, in terms of chametz as well as kidneys. In the case of kidneys, those are legumes that aren't really chametz. If anybody doesn't know the term, indicated whether the percentage, whether it's a major portion, a minor portion,
including excipients, including excipients that are not normally listed in the PDO.
That I don't know. I have to go back and look. I've read it because I wrote the introduction.
When talking about medicines, it's something that goes through the GI tract. That's the only thing that is.
Absolutely. What you inject, like, so inject anything you like.
Pork insulin, there's no.
In fact, you say the GI tract, whatever you give the patient as a suppository, it doesn't have to be kosher either. That's also part of the GI tract. So.
What about 2 feet?
2 feet is perfectly okay. Feet anything.
With a gastric tube?
Right? Absolutely.
Okay. Even a nasal gastric tube.
Is chametz on Pesach?
Even chametz on Pesach. Well, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say even chametz on Pesach because they're dealing with the Isuri Hanoah. I'm sorry, take that back. Not chametz on Pesach, but the rest of the year you can use it. I'm sorry?
Also milk meat combination.
Not milk and meat that has been cooked together, but you can give meat and immediately afterwards give milk, or for that matter, non-cooked milk and meat. I mean, things that have been cooked together.
One last facet.
Okay, last question.
Of the drug question. When you have an alternative drug that's kosher, as opposed to one in a formulary, which our organization has now, which isn't kosher, should you push for the patient to be given the kosher drug, or just let them have the drug that's in the formulary?
What is this kosher?
Shackley vitamins?
Say, for example, the prenatal vitamins that are in our formulary now that were chosen are not kosher. At least they might be kosher.
That doesn't mean they're not kosher.
Right.
Now, what's in them? Okay. What's in them of non-kosher origin?
Maybe I should rephrase it. If you have a drug that has a hechsher, that's an alternative, and it's not in the formulary.
I don't think you have to push a drug just because it has a hechsher. There are lots of things that have a hechsher that don't need a hechsher. That's very nice. I mean, let them have as many hechsherim as possible. But that doesn't mean that you've got to make an issue out of it. If you're prescribing salt to a patient instead of removing salt, you don't have to prescribe diamond salt because it has a hechsher. If you're prescribing a vitamin and there is another compound that has nothing of animal origin, I don't see why you have to push to have them prescribe the one with the hechsher.
What if you don't know?
Find out. It's not that hard.
Where are we find
out? Right, the companies are remarkably open.
You don't know how to word the question.
You don't know how to word the question?
Yeah.
Well, no, that was for Pesach. You want to know for the rest of the year. You ask whether there's, you can ask for, specifically, whether it's got any gelatin or glycerin, or whether it has any animal products or any animal derivatives. If the answer comes back no, you're home clear. If the answer comes back yes, then there's certain other things you want to know. You want to know precisely the nature, what in the world it is. And then the second question is what you're prescribing it for. If you're prescribing, most of this, turns out to be a shuleika derech achilah. And hence you don't have any problems prescribing it for any patient who is sick, as distinct from prescribing it prophylactically or as a vitamin or what have you. If there is another equally good substance available, then by all means prescribe the other substance, but you don't have to make any great issue about it. If you're prescribing something prophylactically that has something of non-kosher origin, then it's a matter of having the same thing compounded minus that ingredient. Do you people have apothecaries?
I can't imagine them making a multivitamin.
Well, multivitamin is a little bit hard. Most other things are...
Well, prenatal vitamins was the actual case at hand.
You can't get the formulary to take the other kind of vitamin?
No, the formulary picks the drug that it's going to
be carrying.
They have their own criteria. And they pick the company of the drug.
You have a free sample.
What you guys need is
Jack in the Box says kosher products with an OU.
What?
Jack in the Box, trade for restaurant, carries packets, the OU on them.
Packets of what?
Salad dressings.
Yeah, so.
So even here, maybe they could get a bid on the lowest.
Maybe the department. Maybe.
I think we should.
Maybe
we should put in a bid.
Yeah, I think
easier just to get a hold of that PDR. Well,
that's for Pesach. That's a list. It has no information on regard to kashrus.
Where are they located?
They're not located anywhere. It's a book. A little book.
If you wanted to get the book, where would you read it?
Write to David Horowitz in New York and give you his address at home. And I'll have
in
Hurwitz,
Brooklyn?
No.
Queens.
Queens.
He lives in Bayside or something. Or Flushing.
Queens.
He's a pediatrician.
Oh, I see. Okay, I think we should call the meeting.
You probably can look him up in the Red Book.
Short question.
List your directory of doctors.
Short question, last question.
What do you call it?
According to the halacha of covering your hair, how much hair is allowed to show?
Short hair.
Well,
we have 15
volumes. How much is allowed to show?
Yeah, when you're covering your hair, how much is allowed to show?
According to everybody except Rav Moshe, absolutely nothing.
According to
Rav Moshe, you always have a cooler someplace, 2 fingers wide. What?
Everyone else says absolutely nothing.
Everyone, just about everybody else says.
Give me Rabbi Weiner's book coming back.
Who's Rabbi Weiner?
Gloria the King's Daughter.
Was
Moshe Weiner came out?
With what?
Kol
Kvod Basmelach Pnima. Kol Kvod Basmelach Pnima, yeah. What does he say?
I mean, he says that a woman has a strand showing that her husband has grounds for divorce.
He says a single strand.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He disagrees with the relationship, as does everybody else.
They were talking about that.
I'm listening.
Is this
in paperback as well?
Yeah.
Judy, I have this in paperback?
I think we have
a okay, all right. I think I have it. Yeah.
If you're dealing with that issue, and if according to everybody, everything has to be covered.
Yeah.
I would venture to say that almost the majority of women have little sideburns.
No. Again, the sideburns are excluded. Everything means that if you take the hairline and take a draw this as kind of a circle, an oval shape, from the front of the head until the back. Anything inside the oval has to be covered. The payas, the female payas, don't have to be covered. That's specifically accepted.
To what degree? Can she have little side locks coming down?
Yes, they can grow as long as they grow. She can curl them and twist them. Yeah, as long as they can grow. Yeah.
Oh, really?
As long as they have. I think we should call the session to close. And we thank Rabbi Blythe very, very much. And participants, and hope that this is the beginning of a series of...
We call
to my dad. Tell him the story.
Yeah.
I just want to tell, I think everyone in our community will enjoy it, and Rabbi Blythe will enjoy it too.
happened to me today. I took my kids because we have 450 kids in the school. Most of them aren't from. So once a year, I'm a first grade teacher. I take them into Los Angeles. They should see other, they should, you know, the kids. There's a mezuzah, there's a yarmulke. They went, you know. So I take them into a day school. I took them into Yavna day school. And we went in and I told the kids there that the reason why I'm bringing my children, I told the first graders, the reason I'm bringing my children is because where we live, there are hardly any Jews and there are no kosher stores. I want them to see there are other kids learning Torah. So then I said, I'll give you an example. And I turned to the Yavni kids. I said, how many of you children have five Jewish families living on your block? They all raised their hand. And I turned to our kids. I said, how many of you have two Jewish families living on your block? Not one out of 36 raised their hand. Mm-hmm. Not one. I mean, it was so striking. Mm-hmm. All the parents, I had nine parents that were with me that just couldn't believe it. So later I was walking out, so Dr. Fox, who's the Afrum woman, but she's the English principal there, comes over to me. She says, you know, you don't hardly have any Jewish people living around it. She says, probably not all the kids in your school are Orthodox, are they? it hit me all of a sudden. So I said, well, just about 85% aren't. It pushed it. It was a revelation to her that there's a school with 450 kids and they're not an Orthodox. I just thought it was something I had to share.
I never thought of the
end. Thanks, Charles.